Bottom of Chaf Gimel and Beis, and we're doing the Mishnah. The Mishnah opens up with the word V'chein, which is a hook connecting us back to the previous Mishnah. Just like in the previous Mishnah, with the case of two women who were captivated, that's a Shvuya, so one Shvuya testifies on the other Shvuya, and she says that she wasn't raped, she wasn't in any way vilified, and therefore she remains as Muteris Lekohen, and she's believed to testify about her friend. And V'chein, and here also we're going to have two people testifying about each other, that the other person is a Kohen Kosher. Now what that means, fundamentally, at least the way Rashi interprets this sugya, is that this individual could eat truma. Because as you know, under the Zar, who's not a Kohen who eats truma, that's a very, very severe violation. That's a chiv misa bidei shamayim. Now, one thing is clear even before we learn the Mishnah. When you need testimony to establish a person as a Kohen, the person who's on trial, so to speak, cannot testify on his own behalf. He must have at least, according to all Tanoim, at least one witness who's testifying on his behalf. Rabbi Yehuda is going to assume you need two witnesses on his behalf. So whether you need one or two is going to be a major controversy. But everybody agrees that he cannot testify about himself. So that's the first case. And this again parallels the previous Mishnah where she said about herself that she's Tahora and she wasn't violated, and the other woman says about herself and they're not believed. They're only believed when they testify for the other person. So that's V'chein Shnei Anoshim. So we have two people that all of a sudden show up in town and we don't know their background. You know, they've never gone up to Duchim. They've never gotten the first Aliyah. What do you say?
Never received the Pinyon HaBen money.
Right, they never received Pinyon HaBen money. They never received Truma or any of the Matonas Kahuna. So the Mishnah says, Ze Omer Kohen Ani. Each one testifies about himself. This one says, I'm a Kohen. Ze Omer Kohen Ani. And the other one testifies about himself that he's a Kohen. Is Enam Neman. That's not enough to establish a Kohen. And Rashi learns it means he cannot eat truma. The Meiri adds he cannot go up to Duchen as a Kohen. And he cannot read the Torah, get the first Aliyah as a Kohen. And why is that? Because in order to establish someone as a Kohen, and we don't know he's a Kohen, you need objective testimony. Meaning somebody has to testify on his behalf. He cannot testify on his own behalf. However, if each one testifies on behalf of the other one, notice it's not just that he says I'm a Kohen, but he says my friend here, my buddy is a Kohen. So the Tanakhama of our Mishnah holds Harei Elu Nemanim, that now each individual has one objective testimony about himself, and we can rely on the testimony of one witness. That's according to the Tanakhama. And the Gemara is going to explain that there's a big chiddush in this Mishnah. Because since these two so-called Kohanim come together, they may be working in cahoots.
Just like the two women.
Yeah, they may have just made like, an agreement with
like
each
the,
other. Yeah, I'll testify for you, you testify for me.
I'm saying that's the V'chein. In other words, we were also concerned with that earlier.
Right, and the chiddush of our Mishnah is that here we're not concerned with that. And we believe that if each one testifies on his friend, that testimony is acceptable, even though again the circumstances look a little bit fishy, a little bit suspicious on the outside, because they came together and they're testifying about themselves, each one about himself and his friend. Maybe, you know, they're in cahoots, there's a collusion here going on. No, the Mishnah says there's something called Eid Echad Neman, one testimony is accepted, and we don't have to delve into the deep psychological shadows here. But Rabbi Yehuda disagrees. Ein Mailin Lekuhuna al Pi Eid Echad. If you want to establish someone as a Kohen, and we have no background, he has no resume, then we need two witnesses minimum, and one witness is not enough. And this makes sense because Truma itself, as we said before, is a real gigantic suffix. It's a suffix Iser. It's a suffix of major proportions because if he's not a Kohen and he gets Truma, then he's a Zar, and that's a violation of a Chiyuv Misa B'dei Shamayim. So in order to paskin on a suffix of that immense proportion, it's not just a regular suffix, you know, you want to know whether whether he can get an Aliyah as a Kohen or not, whether or not he can duchen. I mean, those are minor infractions if he's not really a Kohen. It's not pleasant, but it's not such a big deal. But to give him Truma, and Rashi already interprets that our Mishnah is discussing Truma, Rav Yehuda says that's a Misa, that's almost testimony on a capital crime. And for that, we certainly need two witnesses. So again, just to summarize, the Mishnah is saying that there's a machlokas here between the Tanakhama and Rabbi Yehuda. How many witnesses do we need to establish someone as a Kohen in order to give him Truma? Do we classify this as a case of Eid Echad Neman B'Isurim, that one witness is believed on Isur? Because at the end of the day, Truma for a Zar is a question of Isur. Or do we say no, that since this Isur is much more severe than any other Isur, it's a Chiv Misa that's at stake, therefore we treat it as Dine Nefosh, and we require how many Eidim? Two Eidim. Now, we have a compromise Shita coming up, and that's the Shita of Rabbi Lazar. Rabbi Lazar, on the one hand, is going to accept Rabbi Yehuda, that if there's a serious issue, a question about the status of this individual, whether he's a Kohen or not, you want to give him Truma, then we need two witnesses. However, he says the following, Amosai, at what point do I accept the Shita of Yehuda, we need two witnesses to establish this person as a Kohen? That's only B'makom Sheyesh Oririn. That there's a certain rumor about this person that he's not really a Kohen, or if he is a Kohen, he's a Kohen posel. He's not a qualified Kohen. He's a cholol. Amal b'makom shein orin, in the absence of any registered reason to suspect that he's not a Kohen, then ma'alan l'kun al pi eid echad, then I agree with the shita of the Tanakam. So Rabbi Elezer, as we said, Rabbi Elezer is a middle shita. In certain situations, if there's no Orin, no one's complaining and no one's questioning the status of this Kohen, you simply have no evidence one way or the other, then one witness is sufficient. We rely on his testimony. But if there is a suspicious rumor going around that he is not a Kohen or he's a Kohen posel, then Rabbi Yehuda is right and we need two witnesses. Finally, we have a Shita of Shimon Gamliel, which we don't understand. The Gemara is going to take this up later on. And that's in the name of Rav Shimon ben Askan. Malin l'kuhuna al pi eid echad. Does that mean that he always accepts one witness like the Rabbanon? Does it mean he accepts one witness if there are no Orin, like the Pshara, like the compromise of Rabbi Lazar? We don't know exactly why the Mishnah adds Rav Shimon Gamliel. He doesn't seem to be adding anything that we didn't have before. Why mention him? Or if you want to mention him, you could have said, like, both Rav Lazar and Rav Shimon Gamliel agreed to the following statement. Rav Osa, at this point, we begin the Gemara. Now, this is a fascinating Gemara, and I personally think, and at least in my limited experience, this is a very unique and unusual kind of Gemara. What the Gemara does now is it goes back to all the Mishnayos in this Perek and gives us like an overview answering the following question. Kol Hani Lomeli. Why do we need each Mishnah? So let's count six Mishnayos. And what I'm going to do now is just simply summarize six Mishnayos. The first four all focus on the principle called Hapesh Asar or Hapesh Hithir. The second two, we got to get rid of this table at some point. It's been bothering me for a long, long time. I'm going to guess that it's Max.
I think it's the chair issue. There it is.
Oh, I guess.
I once had a lecture. If you came late, you couldn't get into the class.
Right. We're hinting to that tonight.
No. I object. Aaron Attar is in Atlanta. Evan Sandler is, I don't know where he is, but he's certainly not.
Rabbi Gerson saw me looking for parking. It was just not.
Yeah. So I took the last spot. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So let's go through six Mishnayos. Give you the overview of six. The first one is where Reuven comes to the son of Shimon and he says to the son of Shimon, your father owned this field. It was his, but I bought it from him. Now, keep in mind that when you admit that this field belonged to so-and-so, you can't just claim you bought it from him. You have to produce a document, a shtar, that testifies to that effect. In the absence of that shtar, if you can't prove with any evidence that you bought the field, we assume the Marakama goes back to the original owner. But here the Mishnah says we can believe him because he's talking to the son of Shimon. Reuven is talking to the son of Shimon, and the son of Shimon knows nothing about this field. He doesn't know that this field ever belonged to his father. So for all intents and purposes, Reuven didn't have to say a word. He could have shut up. And we would have assumed that since he's holding on to this field, he's working the field, he has a chazaka of the field, it's his. And it was always his. He inherited it from his father. So that's Mishnah number one. We believe him because he was the one who told us and opened up with his statement that this field belonged to your father. Then we get to the second Mishnah. The second Mishnah deals with the case of Kiyum Shtar, which means that when two witnesses are signed on a document, we have to authenticate their signatures. There are different ways of doing so, but the case that the Mishnah is dealing with is when we summon in those very same two witnesses who are supposedly signed on the document, and we ask them to recognize their signatures. And what do they say to us? Very surprising. They say, yes, we signed on the Shtar, but we were forced under duress to sign on the shtar. We were minors when we signed on the shtar. We were related, and therefore psulim, we were disqualified. And now, what do? So again, the Mishnah seems to reiterate the same principle again of Pesha Asa or Pesha Hita. We would have assumed that this shtar was possible, meaning until we prove that the shtar is innocent, it's assumed to be guilty. Because that's what Chacham established, that until you bring evidence to authenticate signatures on a shtar, we have to assume that it's a forgery. So therefore they didn't have to say a word, because they're the only ones who can recognize their signatures in this particular case. There is no external independent evidence to establish the authenticity of the shtar. So therefore they have a pesha asa pesha hita. They could have sat quietly at home, done nothing, the shtar would have been invalid. They came forward and said, well, this is our signatures, we recognize our signatures, but the shtar is invalid for other reasons. That's called anusim ayinu, ktadim ayinu, psuliedus ayinu. The third case is a woman who we have no reason to assume was married. We don't have any evidence to that effect. She comes in and she tells us a story. I was married, but I was divorced. Eishes isha yisi ugrushani. Again, she has a pesha asa pesha hita. She didn't have to say a word. We would have married her off to the first candidate because we had no assumption, no chazaka that she was ever married. She was the one who admitted that she was married. Now she's believed to say, but I received a divorce from my husband. Normally, she would not be believed to say that without a document, without the get. But here she's believed because of pesha asa. Then we have the fourth case of Pesha Asa Pesha Hita. We don't know about this woman that she was taken into captivity. We have no evidence to that effect. We would marry off to the first Kohen that would apply for the job. But she admits, Nishbesi, that I was captivated. And the law is that a Shvuya is not allowed to marry a Kohen. But then she says, Utahorani, but I was not defiled during that period of captivity. Once again, she's believed because she didn't have to say anything. Now there are two other Mishnayos.
Maybe she just was scared that somebody else would come along and.
Good point, Brian. Maybe you're right. Maybe she was aware of the existence of two witnesses out there, so she ran into Bezdin.
Let me go and be the first to,
Let me get there first, so that I'll have a Peshos HaPeshit. That's an excellent question, and maybe that's going to be one of the answers as to why we needed that Mishnah. Because again, our Gemara is called Kol Hani Lomeli. Why do we need each Mishnah? What is each Mishnah teaching me? Then we have two Mishnayos, the fifth and the sixth, which have nothing to do with Peshas or Peshahit. They have to do with two individuals that come together and testify on themselves and on the next one. And that is two Shvuyos that we know were taken into captivity, and each one testifies about themselves and their colleagues, so to speak, that we were Tahora. And then we have two Kohanim, or supposed Kohanim, that come together, and each one testifies about himself, I'm a Kohen, and my buddy is also a Kohen. So in each case, the Gemara wants to know, what's the Chiddush in the Mishnah? If I had only case one, I wouldn't know case two. If I had cases one and two, I wouldn't know case three. It's a very fascinating and analytic Gemara. You know, I would almost say that if somebody wanted to learn how to learn Gemara, this would be such a typical standard kind of Gemara. It would really teach you how to learn. Says the Gemara Tzrichi. We need each case in the Mishnah. And now the Gemara is embarking on a project to show you in six cases why each halach in the six cases is a chiddush. It tells me something I wouldn't have known. And the Gemara says the following. The Itani, if we only had the first Mishnah, again, the first Mishnah was that a person comes forward and he says, this field belonged to your father, but I bought it from your father. And the Mishnah says, Moda Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbi Yeshua was the Tana in the first Perek who denied Migu. If you remember, there was a case where a woman was alone with a man, and when we asked her what's going on, she said, well, we had a relationship, but he's a kosher, and if I'm not posel. And Rabbi Yeshua is unwilling to believe her, even though she could have had a migu, she could have said, we didn't have a relationship, there were no witnesses that testified on that relationship. But Moda Rabbi Yeshua, in this case, where she has, or I should say he has, a Pesha Asar Hua Pesha Hitir, there he's believed. Because that goes beyond a migu. And that was the discussion that we had about Shor Shochet Lefanecha. That's not for us tonight. Far. Says the Gemara, you know what? I'll tell you why we should believe him in this case. And that's not going to teach me anything about the second case or any of the other cases that we had in all the Mishnayos. Why do we believe him in this case? Mishum de'ika drora dimamona. What does this mean, drora dimamona? What we're saying here about Drora de Mamona is the following. That we honestly believe that when he started his statement, he had in mind to complete his statement. When he said the Resha, the first half, namely this son that belongs to your father, clearly we have reason that there's an indication that he wants to tell us that he bought the field from his father. And we'll explain that in just a minute. That's called Drora de Mamona. Because clearly he understood that if he makes the first statement, he's going to lose as a result. He's going to have to forfeit the field. Because what's he saying? I admit that this field was not my father's, it was your father's. And in the absence of any evidence that he bought the field, he doesn't have a shtar to testify to that effect, he's going to forfeit the field. It must be, therefore, that when he began his statement, He had in mind to complete his statement, namely to say that I bought it from your father. So it becomes what we call one indivisible testimony. Again, a person is not like HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and who can say many things at once, like Shomer V'Zoch B'Dibur Echad. A person starts a statement, you have to give him a chance to finish the statement. But take both dimensions of the statement as one, in one single context. And when he said, so you have to give him a chance to finish his sentence, namely to get the words out of the of his mouth, Lukachtio mimenu, I bought it from your father, because he doesn't want to lose this field. So the very moment he comes in and he confesses that this field belonged to Shimon's father, then Reuven stands to lose the field. Give him a chance to explain why he still claims with his chazaka that he owns the field, that he has legal rights to the field. So again, the premise here is that the first case is telling us Pesha Asa Pesha Hitir, meaning that even Rabbi Yeshua, who denies Migu, still accepts the credibility of Pesha Asa Pesha Hitir. And it's logical in that case to accept the principle, apply the principle of Pesha Asa Pesha Hitir. Why? Because he doesn't want to lose his mamon, and clearly when he began his statement, he wanted to complete his statement. What the Gemara is driving at here is that what underlies the principle of Pesha Asa Pesha Hitir is the integration of the Reisha and the Seifa of the two statements, the beginning and the end, into one whole testimony. If, on the other hand, we have suspicion to believe that when he started his testimony and he presented the Reisha, maybe he had no intention to complete his statement and add the Seifa. That would break up HaPesh Asa Peshit to the underlying logic of this principle of Pesha Asa Pesha Hitir, is you got to accept an entire statement of a person. But in a case where we would have suspicion that maybe he started his statement, period, and now we could wedge between the beginning of his statement and the end of his statement some sort of a barrier and put a period, in such a case he doesn't have a Pesha Asa Pesha Hitir, because once we accept his first testimony, then he made a confession, we cannot accept his seifa, the last testimony. That's what Gemara is going to say now. Avol Edim, in the case where two witnesses are summoned to verify their signatures, Deleka Dror Demamona, they don't stand to lose a dime by saying, yes, these are our signatures, because the validity of the shtar is not relevant to the Edim themselves. They don't gain or lose based on the validity of the document. That's only relevant to somebody else. So they don't have a drawer de mamona. There's no reason to assume that when they started their statement and they said, yeah, ksav yadenu zeh, we recognize our signatures, that they had mind to complete the statement. Emol lo. Perhaps when they completed their statement, they were adding a whole new dimension, a new story. Originally, in their original intention, when they came in to testify, they wanted to verify the shtar, and then afterwards, they made a decision to change the tune of their testimony, and instead of validating the shtar, to invalidate the shtar. What the Gemara is implying is that there's a head-on collision, an absolute contradiction, between the impact of the reisha, their opening line of yes, ksav yadenu huzeh, and the impact of the seifa, but anusim ayinu. Because what's the impact of the original statement? What's the status of the shtar if you accept ksav yadenu huzeh? What do you say? It's valid, because again, there's no question about the shtar other than one single question. We don't have reason to believe that the Edim were Ketanim or Anusim, that they signed under duress. We have none of that. That's not on the table. What's on the issue on the table is, did they sign the shtar? Once they say those magical words, Ksav Yadenu Huzeh, this is our signature, that's my John Hancock, as we say in America, then at that point the shtar is validated. Now he wants to come up with a contradictory statement, and he wants to invalidate the shtar and say, well, we were under duress, we were ketanim, we were psulim. Maybe he changed his mind midway. What do I mean by change his mind? Now he's offering a separate edus. He has no vested interest. The entire issue at stake is the shtar, whether it qualifies or not. They're saying two contradictory things. Now, it's common that a human being will realize midway what the implications of what he's saying is, and then decide to change his tune. If that be the case, if he comes up with a contradiction, then he cannot do so. And who remembers here, perhaps, the principle that blocks him from being able to now change his mind and invalidate the shtar that he originally validated? Anybody know what that's called? Okay, I'm going to teach it to you. Keva, what? Excellent, Max. Keva Chehigin Shuveni Choser Magid. You give me a lot of Nachas Ruach when you say that, because it's a very important principle that Edom can't retract their Edus. They don't have the right to do so. Once the Edus is registered, that's it. It's a done deal. They can't reverse their Edus. Here, the Gemara thinks there's a reversal of the Edus. In a case where we have reason to believe that from the get-go, when he started his testimony, he meant to complete it, and we can't stop him midway, that's ha-peshos ha-peshehita. You have to hear the whole story. So when a person has vested interest vis-a-vis this field, because he wants to own the field and support his claim to chazaka, to live in the field, then we have to believe that when he started his sentence by saying, Sodazu shalavosecha hayo, belong to your father, now he's going to clarify why it's mine by saying that I bought it from your father. So there's one complete edus. Who owns the field? Yes, you inherited this field, but you didn't inherit the field, meaning you could have inherited the field if not for the fact that I bought the field. That's the entire statement. It's an indivisible statement. You have to take both the beginning of the statement and the end of the statement. Because otherwise, the man is shooting himself in the foot. But in a case where a person has no vested interest, he doesn't have a drawer of the mamon, he's testifying on Yenim Shtar, then in that case, we have to analyze the two statements, the first and the second, and we might entertain the possibility that these are two separate statements, and they contradict one or the other in terms of the chalosa edus, the purpose and the implication of the edus, and therefore kevin shigin shuvan echozer magid. Once I separate between the reish and the sefer, and I have two independent units of testimony, the first, the impact of the first is that the shtar is valid, the impact of the second, the shtar is not valid, then I take his reish and I apply the principle of kevin shigin shuvan echozer magid. Once you've established your edus, you cannot rescind it. Now the Gemara wants to know, what do we do in the reverse? The Itana Edim. Let's say the Mishnah could have told us now the case of the second Mishnah, dropped the case of the first Mishnah, and we would make a Kal v'chomer. If in the case of Edim, who testify on the Shtar, and they have no vested interest, they have no drawer to Mamona, and yet, nevertheless, we cannot stop them midway. We have to allow them to tell us the whole story about this shtar, and whether it's valid or it's not valid. So then how much more so in the case where a person has a drawer to mamon, you have to give him a chance, an opportunity to finish his statement and establish his rights, his ownership rights to the field. Says the Gemara, no. I would say that in the case of Edim, Mishum Dili Alma, meaning because they are testifying Li Alma. Li Alma means to the outside world, meaning their testimony is relevant to the Malva and the Lova. Because if you remember, the Malva produces this shtar against the Lova, and he says, look, the shtar testifies that you borrowed money from me. And now the Edom are called upon, they're summoned into Beis Din to validate the shtar. So if they wanted to testify on the first half of their edus and say ksav yodenu huzen, they would have stopped at that point without adding anusim hayinu, etc., then we would say that there's something very embarrassing here about these edim. How could they have the chutzpah to say one thing and then contradict themselves? Meaning, when they came into Beis Din, are you telling me that their intention was to validate the shtar? And then all of a sudden, midway, they're going to tell the judges, wait a minute, no, the shtar is invalid. That's not something that's acceptable. That's humiliating. That's an embarrassing situation.
Everybody has an agenda, right? I mean, people come in and they give edus because they want the result. I mean, that's how it is. I mean, it could be false edus, it could be...
So again, what we're trying to analyze here, Brian, is did the edim change their mind midway? And really, they're testifying now a separate entity, a separate unit that contradicts the first testimony. I was saying that it doesn't make sense to assume that the second half of the testimony is a new idea that popped into their head as they were speaking to Beis Din, and all of a sudden they had a change of heart. Why doesn't it make any sense? Because they're testifying on this shtar, on behalf of the Malva, let's say. And they're coming into Beis Din to say, yes, this shtar is valid. We signed on the shtar. Now all of a sudden they're going to change their mind and invalidate the shtar. So the Gemara says that there's a strong logic, again, if we only had this one Mishnah, to assume that they didn't have a change of heart. Because the Gemara says that to have a change of heart, when you initially came in to testify on behalf of the Malva to validate the shtar, and all of a sudden you're going to say, no, the shtar is invalid, you know, it's technical. That's a bit of a bizayon. That's a little bit embarrassing to the Eidim. And therefore there's a very compelling reason to believe that the Eidim really wanted to tell a whole story here about the shtar, the truth and the whole truth about the shtar. Yes, we signed it, but we signed it and it was an invalid signature because we were under duress, etc., etc. Avol iu l'nafshe, but in the case where Reuven says this field that I'm holding on to in the time being belonged to your father, in such a case, Ema lo. And here we're on the top of Daf Chav Dalid Amud Aleph. Here I would say that, you know what? Maybe he changed his mind midway. Why? Because when he started his testimony, he was of the mindset that I have to be honest about this field and I have to admit, in what's called a hodas baldin, a confession on the part of someone who is a litigant in the case, that this field belongs to you because you inherited it from your father. But then he grabs onto himself, gets a hold of himself, he says, wait a minute, you know, maybe honesty is not the best policy. In this case, I'm going to lose a piece of real estate that's worth who knows how much. So he decides to change his mind. And he doesn't want to lose his hold, his grip. He doesn't want to loosen his grip on the field. And therefore he says, ulkachtiyo mimenu. All of a sudden he wants to change his tune. In other words, what the Gemara is saying is that although in the case of ksavyadenu huzev alanusimayinu, we definitely define it as one continuous, indivisible edus, one agodas edus, and that's called Peshasa Peshitim. But in this case of Sada Zushal Avichai Sol Kartia Mimenu, maybe it's two separate Haggadahs. One Haggadah is on the field. I have to admit that this field belonged to your father. Now, he decides, wait a minute, but I have to make a claim on this field. So now he wants to protect his ownership rights. And then he says, well, L'Kartia Mimenu. So in the first part of his testimony, we're asking about the history of this field. The field is, so to speak, on trial. And the witnesses are, not the witnesses, I'm sorry. In this case, the modeh, the one who confesses, he comes in, he says, you know what? The history of this field is such that it belonged to your, meaning Shimon's father. Now, he wants to change his tune. He realizes that if things will be left as is, if he doesn't add another sentence, then through Haudas Baldin, by virtue of his confession, he's going to lose the field. So now he has a change of heart, and he decides to do something out of desperation that would make a claim for the field. So what does he say? Ah, I bought it from your father. So it's not really one indivisible Haggadah. Kamash Malan, that's why we need the first Mishnah to teach me this chiddush, that even in a case when a person has vested interest and he started with a confession and then he adds, no, but it's mine, and we have reason to believe that maybe he's changing his mind. In the case of Eidus, that are testifying about someone else, the Malva, the Lova, they don't have any vested interest. So it would look very strange if they were testifying on behalf of the Malva, and now they're going to testify that the shtar is possible against the Malva. That's a complete change in the wind of their Eidus. They don't change winds. We must assume that from the get-go, they wanted to tell us the entire story about this shtar. But in the case where you have vested interest, maybe midway he decided, hey, you know what, I'm an idiot. I'm going to lose a piece of property that's worth who knows how much. I've got to do something really quick. So he decides to fabricate a whole story about how I bought this field from your father. And therefore I would have thought in that case, maybe it's two different agados, and we're not allowed to take the second agada because it's a total reversal on the admission, on the confession of Hodas Baldin on the first part of his agada. Kamash Malon, now we have two Mishnayos, and each Mishnah has its own Chiddush. So let's just review. The first Mishnah is telling me a Chiddush that I don't believe he's changing his mind, but I believe that from the get-go he wanted to say that I bought this field from your father. The second Mishnah is telling me a Chiddush because I would have thought that since they don't have any vested interests over here, maybe they made a change in their Edus and they decided midway that they want to add Anusim Ayinu, but it wasn't part of their original thought and their original intention. So each Mishnah has a separate Chiddush to tell me a Pesha Asa or Pesha Hitir. And now we get to the third Mishnah. The Yashmin and Hani Tarati, if we only had the first two Mishnayos. Namely, Sodazu Shalavicha Isolakhtiya Mimenu. And Xavyadenu Huze Avala Nusim Hayinu, I would have said that what's common in these two cases, Mishum Dimamona. These are monetary issues. Number one, who owns the field? And number two, is this shtar valid in the hands of the malve, in the lender, in order to give him claim to the borrower? Avol Eishes Ish, but if a woman says in the third Mishnah, I was married, but I received a divorce, Di Isura, that's already a whole different element, a whole different dimension of Halacha. Here we're talking about the Isur Eishes Ish, because by her own confession, she is a married woman, and she's not allowed to have relations, she's not allowed to get married with someone else. Amolo, maybe in such a case, when she adds the testimony in this Garashti that I received a get, and she wants to remove this Isur, maybe she wouldn't be believed. And basically the premise of this Hamamina, if we didn't have the third Mishnah, is that there are two different realms in Halacha, and one cannot teach or impact on the other. You can't derive conclusions from one to the other. There are certain rules and regulations that govern Dine Mamanis, and there are other rules and regulations that govern Dine Isa Veheter. So the fact that there is a rule called Peshasa Peshahitir that would give someone rights to Mama, that doesn't prove a thing about Peshasa Peshahitir to be Mater and Isa. Or maybe alternatively, what the Gemara has in mind here is that Eishes Ish is a very severe Isur. In Dini Momenos, okay, you know, Gzela is not something to laugh at, but you wouldn't put it on the same level as having a relationship with a married woman. I mean, a person steals, maybe we'll give him a couple of lashes for that, but we won't put him to death. If a person lives with a married woman, Chas V'Shalom, that's considered a capital crime. So the fact that we have this credibility of a Peshas and Peshahitir and Dini Mominos, when we're trying to clarify the evidence and what happened and who really has the rights to this moment, that's one thing. But to clarify the status of an Eishes Ish, which is a capital issue, here we're not going to rely on a Peshas and Peshahitir, so we certainly need the third Mishnah. No, but if that be the case, why do we need the fourth Mishnah? Nishbesi Utahorani. Lomali, why do I need that Mishnah? After all, that Mishnah is dealing with a lower, you know, a lowercase Isur. We're not dealing with Eishes Ish, we're dealing with a Derabbanan Bechlal, meaning on a Torah level she can marry a Kohen. Derabbanan made a Gzera, they assumed that since she was taken captive by the non-Jews, that she was defiled, and therefore she cannot marry a Kohen. Tosis, by the way, is not so happy about this. If you take a look at Tosis, he says, Kashal Rajba, the top toast on Chav Dalet, Amai Lo Mishani, why couldn't the Gemara give a simple answer? Mishum Deboi L'Misnei Seifa, because this Mishnah of Nishbesi U'Tahora is coming to teach you what it says in the Seifa, that Im Yesh Edim Shenishbeis V'Omer Tahorani Einon Amenis, that she's only believed to say that she's Tahora because of the absence of witnesses to testify that she was taken into captivity. But the Mishnah insists that if there are witnesses, we have independent evidence to establish that she was taken into captivity, then she's not believed. It says Tosfos Yesh Lomar, that's not a chiddush. Why? Lo itzrich. The Misefa de Masnisin, there's a Seifa later on Daf Chavav, Shaminele will derive this conclusion. The Katani Seifa, Ir Shekavshua Charkum, if the legions of foreign armies take over a Jewish city, is kol kohanos shenimtzu b'tocham psulos. Then we have testimony that they, each one of these women who want to marry a Kohen or are married to a Kohen, are taken into captivity. Einom nemonos lo matorah. The Mishnah says explicitly that she cannot testify in such a case that she's tahora. So the only believability that she has to testify that she's tahora if she's a shvuyah is based on pesha asa pesha hitir. We've already established pesha asa pesha hitir in the case of eishes ish. How much more so in the lower case situation of shvuyah? Says the Gemara, Mishum Kabai Lemisne, because what happens if after she testified Nishbesi Utahorani and we accepted her testimony based on Peshas and Peshitir, then she went ahead and got married to a Kohen, which was okay because Bezdin gave her the green light to marry a Kohen. But after that marriage, Bo Adim, witnesses come to Bezdin and they testify that she was a Shvuya. And the Mishnah says, "Harei zo lo teitze." We're not going to bust up the marriage between her and a Kohen once we allowed her to get married. We gave her the license. We gave her the permission. We're not going to undermine that heter that we gave her. And even though now it turns out she has no peshas or peshahita, and this is sort of like the case that Brian was mentioned before, that maybe she suspected that witnesses would come and testify that she was a shvuya, so she quickly ran into Bezdin with her peshas or peshahita to tell us the story. But the Mishnah says, nevertheless, if she already got married, in other words, if she didn't get married, we're going to rescind her credibility and her peshas or peshita, because now we have independent evidence, so we have two eidim testifying that she was a shvuya. So she's not believed to say Torah. However, if she went ahead based on the license that Bezdin gave her and she got married, in such a case, the Mishnah tells us a gevaldig chiddush, namely that we're not going to break up the marriage, even though her peshas or peshita is up in smoke, it's completely gone, it doesn't exist anymore. But we're not going to create an Iser of a Shvuya once we, Bezdin, allowed her to get married and she actually got married. But wait a second. Rabosai, at this point in time, we have to ask ourselves the following question. Well, what would be, in Mishnah number 3, Eishes Ish Ani Haisi, Ugrush Ani, if Adam come after, and we believed her, and if we let her get married, not to a Kohen, and now two witnesses come in and say that we know that she was married to the first husband. What happens now? Do we break up the marriage if she got married to someone else based on the license of Bezdin? So the Gemara says that in fact is a machlokes that we learned back on Daf Chaf Gimel. Hanicha, what you're saying makes sense. Laman demasne asefa, according to Rabba Bar Ovin, who learns that the din of Mishenisei Sloteitze was relevant to and exclusively relevant to the Seifa, namely the case of Nishbesi Utahoran. But in the case of Eishes Ishayisi Ve Ugrushani, if Adam come in afterwards, we're going to break up the marriage. So there's a big chiddush here in Nishbesi Utahoran, then in Nisei Sloteitze. El Amandavastia Resha, but Rav Oshia is the one who says that when the Mishnah says, this is Mishnah number 4 in Aperik, that in Bo Eidim Acher Kach Mishanises is Lo Teitze, that refers to the Resh as well, even to the case of Eishes Isha Yisi Vinis Garashti, which means that we already have a tremendous chiddush here in the third Mishnah, that if two Eidim come after she was given the license and she got married, based on her Peshas HaShita, and now they're undermining the Peshas HaShita, nevertheless, we leave her in that state of marriage, we're not going to break up the marriage, is Michael and Mema. So what's the Chiddush of the fourth Mishnah in the case of Eishes Ish? Because, in the case of Shvuya Hayisi Utahorani, how much more so in Nisei Sloteitze? Because if in Nisei Sloteitze, in the case of Eishes Ish, which is an Avera Chamura, it's a capital crime of Mises Bezdin, nevertheless, Loteitze, we gave her the heter, we're not going to rescind it, you know, no backs touch blacks, then how much more so in the case of Shvriyani, which is only an Issa Drabbanon, we're going to apply the principle of Nisei Sloteitze. So we have a problem now according to Rav Oshia. We can square very well according to Rav Chia, according to Rabba Bar Ovin. Says the Gemara, no. According to Rav Oshie, we're going to have to offer a different explanation to justify the fourth Mishnah, Mishum de Kabay Lemisne. Because the Mishnah wants to tell us, this is, you know, the fourth Mishnah is only an introduction to the fifth Mishnah. What's the fifth Mishnah? Shtei Noshim She Nishbu. If two women were both taken captivity, and now we have to assume that they become disqualified to a Kohen, but each one now testifies, not only on themselves, but also on their colleague. In other words, zu al zu, they testify one on the other. Is the Mishnah says, "Areu nemanos, nemanos," that they are believed, and there's a chiddush in that Mishnah, and that's what the Mishnah wants to tell us, that a woman is believed to say that her friend who is a shvuya is tahora. Says the Gemara, I'm not so happy with that either, because shtei nashim shenishbu lomali, even that chiddush that one woman could testify on the other is not a chiddush, because the Mishnah later on says that afilu eved o shifcha nemenes lahoyed al shvuya shi tahora, that even someone who's not normally qualified for testimony is accepted, his testimony or her testimony is accepted to establish that this shvuya is muteres, is tahora. So the answer is, I might think that since these two women came together, and we know that each one that they're a shvuya, and now each one wants to testify on the other one that she's tahora, maybe there was a collusion, maybe they came together as a cartel, you know, to work this out. I'll testify on your behalf and you testify on my behalf. So it's a little bit suspicious here. Kamash Malon, the Mishnah wants to tell us that we're not choshish for gomlin. We don't assume that each witness is testifying on behalf of the other one in order to, you know, because in the framework of this agreement that they made, one helps the other. But rather, we're going to apply the principle of Eidecha Nembi Surin, and she's believed to testify on her friend, and vice versa. Now we get to the sixth Mishnah. V'chein Shnei Anoshim, two people come, and each one says about himself, I'm a Kohen. So the Mishnah says, Einom Nemonim, they're not believed. Lovely. We certainly know that a person can't testify about himself that he's a Kohen. We need at least a minimum of one witness. The Gemara answers, Mishum de Kabay Lemisne Sefer. The Mishnah wants to tell us in the Sefer, Plukta de Rabbi Yehuda Rabbanan. How many witnesses do we need to establish someone as a Kohen? The Chachamim insists that one witness is sufficient, and the Rabbanan, I'm sorry, and Rabbi Yehuda insists that we need two witnesses. And Rabbi Yehuda is not going to rely on the testimony of one witness, because Rabbi Yehuda holds that achilas truma is such a severe issur that we cannot rely on one witness. Again, I want to make a comment here as we pass by here, and that is that when we talk about truma, we can talk about different categories of truma. There's something called truma d'oraisa, for example, in the five species of grain, and in the case of olives and grapes, tirosh v'yitzar. But then there's something called truma derabanan. For example, truma on oranges, which doesn't fit into the category of truma d'oraisa, the seven categories, therefore it's only truma derabanan. And certainly in the case of vegetables or legumes, that's called truma derabanan. So that when we insist, according to Rabbi Yehuda, that we need two witnesses to establish a person as a Kohen for Truma, that's only for Truma d'oraisa, because the violation of Truma d'oraisa, if it's eaten by a Zar, is a Chiv Misa. But there's also something called Truma d'Rabbanan. Certainly Rabbi Yehuda would accept the testimony of one aid to allow this person as a Kohen to eat Truma Sirakos. Okay, that was just on the side. So now again, the Chiddush of our sixth Mishnah is that as far as Achilas Truma is concerned, the Rabbanan are willing to rely on one aid and activate the principle of Eidecha Nem Bisurin, whereas the Shita Rabbi Yehuda is that Eidecha Nem Bisurin doesn't apply in the case of Kohen who wants the Truma Doraisa because of the severity of that Isur. And therefore we need two witnesses and less will not be sufficient. This, my friends, ends what I call Hakofa Aleph of tonight's learning and establishes why we need each of the six Mishnayos. At this point, Hakofa Beis, now the Gemara quotes a Braisa which formulates the machlokes between Rabbi Yehuda and Chacham. Tana Rabban. So now we have two witnesses that come into Beis Din to testify. One of them says, Ani Kohen v'chaveri Kohen. And the other one says, Ani Kohen v'chaveri Kohen. Is Naaman. According to the Chachamim, we can rely on the testimony of one witness. Lachilo b'truma, and now his buddy and he, both because of the reciprocal testimony, can eat truma. However, the eino neman lahasio isha. One witness is not sufficient to marry off this Kohen to a woman. Now, what does this mean? So I'm going to present to you the way Tosfos understands Rashi. This is Tosfos Dibra Maskil Aval. And midway, he rejects Rashi, and Rabbeinu Tam offers another pshat in the sugya. But the first half of Tosfos is dedicated to understanding Rashi in the sugya. Rashi understands in this sugya that a woman who wants to marry this person, and she's what we call a miucheses, meaning she doesn't have any psulim in her family, in her lineage, and she's not allowed to marry a posel, then she needs the testimony of two witnesses to clarify that this individual that she wants to marry is not a mamzer. Like today, for example, if you want to marry someone, so you go to the rabbanut, and the rabbanut is going to determine whether or not there's an absolute kashrus here, that there's no psul, there's no mamzerus in the family, there's no psul ekal, and therefore we can marry the two together.
Does that seem far-fetched? No, there's the issue.
Yeah, Tosus doesn't like.
I'm saying the issue here is not mamzerus. All these, as we don't assume people are mamzerim. We don't assume.
Excellent. So I see that
all we're trying,
Rabbi Goldschneider, you're a bucky in a perek in Kiddushin that's called Asara Yuchsin.
No.
And the yisod of that perek is, and I'll quote to you the very famous principle, is Kulam b'ches, kol ha-mishpachos b'cheskas kashrus heim.
Right.
That every family in Israel, until they're proven guilty, is assumed to be innocent, meaning they're all ksheros.
Right.
So we don't assume that any individual who comes from a mishpacha is a mamzer or a nasin or any other psulei kol. So Rashi's pshat here, says Tosfos, is very difficult. Why would the Brisa establish that you need the clarification of two witnesses to establish that this person who wants to marry this woman is not a mamzer and he's a kosher? Why would we suspect him to be a mamzer? Kol hamishpachos b'cheskes ksheros. Comes along the Ra'ah, quoted the Shita Mekubetzes, and he wants to defend Rashi. And he says the following, based on his analysis of the Sugya in Asara Yuchsin. He says that, yeah, kol ha-mishpachas b'cheskas ksherosin. That's only because we have a mishpacha that lives amongst the Jewish community. However, if somebody comes mimedinas hayam, and we have no knowledge of his mishpacha, in such a case, we need a raya for Yuchsin to establish that he's not coming from a family of Basulim, of mamzerim. And this is a tremendous chiddush of the Ra'ah. I said the Ra'ah, but actually it's the Ramah, Reish Mem Hei, to defend Rashi here, that our case here is a case of a man who comes from Medina Sayyam, and we don't know whether there's any psulei kol in the mishpach that he came from. And therefore he himself might be a mamzer. And according to the Ramah, Rashi would maintain that in such a case he doesn't come under the universal principle of kol ha-mishpachos b'cheskes ksherosin. And we have to be choshesh that maybe he's a mamzer. And in order to clarify his kashrus l'kol, for the sake of this woman who's a ksher and she wants to marry him, we need two witnesses to testify on his kashrus. So again, in order to defend Rashi, says the Ramah, we have to make two assumptions. Assumption number one is that this person that we're talking about, who's the subject of our brisa, is coming from Medina Sayyam. He's not a member of the community. His mishpacha is not part of our community. He's coming from yonder, and we don't know what his status is. The second premise is that not only is our Mishnah talking about such a case, but that in such a case of Abba Medina Sayyam, we don't apply the principle of Kol HaMishpachos B'Cheskes K'sheres Hein, and therefore we require absolute testimony to remove the possibility that he's a mamzer and to allow him to marry a Bas Yisrael. Those are the two premises, says the Rama, that could make Rashi understandable. But Rabbeinu Tam rejects Rashi, and he has a whole different pshat in the sugya. Truth be told, in order for me to understand Rabbeinu Tam's pshat in the sugya, we would have to be deep into Asar Yuchsin. Your mamash has to be holding in Asar Yuchsin. I'll just read to you the words of Rabbeinu Tam. It's on line 4 of Tosis Diva Maskel Avol, and he says, Nirul Rabbeinu Tam, de la sio isha de ka'omar hainu la sio biduka midalid imos. And there's a Mishnah in Perek Asor Yuchsin that speaks about marrying a woman, and she has to be, we have to check out 4 grandmothers, you know, grandmother, great-grandmother, great-great-grandmother, 4 generations in order to establish her Yuchsin. So in other words, Rabbeinu Tam is sort of like turning the table over here. We're not talking about someone who came from Medina Sayyam and we have to check out his yuchsin, but rather we want to check out this woman's yuchsin. So again, as I said before, I'm not willing to discuss Rabbeinu Tam with you because honestly, I would need a lot of research to figure out Rabbeinu Tam, so that therefore we're going to suffice it for tonight with Rashi, the way the Rama explains Rashi. So let's go back now to the Brice. So what would be the case of a group of people who would testify about each other reciprocally, and let's work out the number game in which we can accept 2 witnesses and establish that she can marry this man who came from Medina Sayyam. Says the Braisa, Achiyu Shlosha. We need 3 people coming together, again from Medina Sayyam, we're assuming like the Yad Ramah, and what happens is that Shnayim Me'idin Alzeh Ushnayim Me'idim Alzeh. In other words, from this group of 3, we can establish 2 objective witnesses for each of them, because each of them is mutually going to establish the kashrus of the other 2. Again, as far as himself is concerned, he's not an accepted objective witness, but he can testify on behalf of the other 2. And we can say that about each one of the 3. So in such a case, the Brice establishes that a woman who's a miucheses can marry any of these 3 Joes, any of these 3 Kohanim, let's say, because we have 2 witnesses, testimony testifying on behalf of each of those 3. How do we do that? Because if there are 3 Kohanim, and each one is testifying about himself and the other 2, then mathematically, it works out that you have 2 witnesses for each one of them. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda says, "Af even in the case of 1 witness, eino neman lachilo betruma." You told me in the race of this brisa that as far as truma is concerned, 1 witness is enough. Ani kohen v'chaveri kohen, and you didn't require 3 Kohanim. Well, you require 2 Kohanim. Each one is testifying about himself and his friend, so there's only 1 witness on each of these people in order to allow them to have the status of a Kohen to each Ruma. And Rabbi Yehuda says, Eino Neman, Achiyu Shlosha. The same Shlosha that I needed for Yuchsin, I require for Truma to establish that he's a Kohen. And therefore, if you have 3, Shnayim Me'idim Alzeh, Shnayim Me'idim Alzeh, each one of the 3 testifies about himself and the other 2, so we have 2 witnesses on the others, and then each one of the 3 can eat truma. However, if let's say you had only 1 witness on behalf of each of these potential, what we're doing, candidate Kohanim, then that would not be sufficient. So the Gemara says, what is the Svara of Rabbi Yehuda and what is the Svara of Rabbanu? And until this point, honestly, I thought that the Machlokus was how to classify Achilas Truma for a Kohen. Is it Isurim or is it considered like something much more severe than Isur? But now, I have to admit, the Gemara seems to present another approach. L'neimra, shall we say that what's the issue? What's the Yisod HaMachlokes between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbana? The Rabbi Yehuda Chayesh L'gomlin V'Rabbanan Lo Chayesh L'gomlin. The entire controversy, this whole debate, can be broken down to the following issue. When two people come into Beis Din and each one has to testify about himself and his friend, do we think that this is very suspicious? And maybe they made up with each other that each one would testify on behalf of his friend. You do me a favor, right? What we say in English, one hand washes the other, right?
One hand scratches the back.
Well, one hand scratches the back of the other. And we're going to work in cahoots. That's called Chayshida L'gomlin. So in other words, it's not the way I thought that according to Rabbi Yehuda, because of the severity of Truma, therefore Rabbi Yehuda requires two Edim. The Gemara is saying something else. That we have to be nervous about Truma because of Chayshinon L'gomlin. But fundamentally, if not for Chayshinon L'gomlin, one witness would be enough. And I think what's moving the Gemara here is the question, why did Rabbi Yehuda make this statement in the context of two candidate Kohanim who came into Beis Din? Why not ask the following question? What happens if a person is on trial, so to speak? Beis Din has to decide whether he's a Kohen or not. One person. And somebody comes in who's not related to this case, we'll call him Yisrael, and he testifies that this guy, I know him to be a Kohen. And Rabbi Yehuda would reject that. Apparently Rabbi Yehuda would admit that one witness is okay to testify about a person that he's a Kohen. He only argues with Rabbanan in the specific case where two people come into Beis Din, both claiming that they're Kohenim, each one testifying on himself and on his body. In such a case, says Rabbi Yehuda, the circumstances look very suspicious, and that's called Chayshina L'gomlin. Maybe they were working in tandem. As we said before, one hand washes the other. So the Gemara says that's a problem. Because Vaha Ibcha Shamin Lahu. So Rabbi Goldschneider, can I trouble you just to open up the door? I'm trying to see. My watch is a little fast. But it could be that it's already 9:30. I don't know.
1 minute.
One more minute. So I just want to introduce the next piece of Gemara so that you know we won't battle for the next minute. We're going to now learn a Mishnah, which is later on in Masechet Ksubos, and in that Mishnah, the Shitos are reversed. And it's Dafka the Chachamim who are afraid of Gomlin. Maybe they're in cahoots. And Rabbi Yehuda says, I don't have to worry about Gomlin. And I can accept their testimony, even if they seem on the outside to be working in cahoots. And basically we're going to have a double stira. We're going to have a contradiction between one statement of Rabbi Yehuda and the other, and a contradiction between one shita, one statement of the Rabbanan and the other. Because here, in our Mishnah, Rabbi Yehuda is Choshesh L'Gomlin, the Rabbanan are not Choshesh L'Gomlin. In the Mishnah later on, it's the exact opposite. Okay, Rabbosai, so we'll stop here.